This week on Retronauts, we're shiny, happy podcasters holding hands. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey. And this week, we are talking about Shiny Entertainment, the developer that created Earthworm Jim and then struggled to find a hit afterwards, even if the rest of their output was just as weird. So none of these games could sustain an entire Retronauts episode, but I figured it was only fair to round them all up for a single discussion because Shiny made some interesting, if very flawed, video games that merits our treatment. Before I go on any further, who is here with me today in this Zencaster room?
Hello, it's John Lindemann from Digital Foundry. I'm excited to talk about this. I love some Shiny. And no, Tommy Tallarico did not compose Earthworm Jim. Just going to say it.
Someone else did all the work on that, but we can at least point listeners in that direction.
Yes,
and
please.
Who else is here with us today?
Yeah, hi, I'm Stuart Jip, and I'm happy to continue holding hands. This is nice. You know, I don't normally do this. Yeah.
We should do it more often as a people. I mean, they tried Hands Across America. It didn't really work, but maybe we can get it going again in 2026. Before I go on any further, though, I'll give my own personal experience, but I want to know your experience with Shiny's games. Let's go to John. John, how about you and Shiny?
So I've essentially played nearly every one of these games at the time. So when they were new, I experienced them, you know, starting. I did actually play some of the prior games, but that probably, I guess, Aladdin is the first one. It's not technically Shiny, but, you know, the legacy that we'll get to. But Earthworm Jim, I was there right away. Multiple versions. We'll talk about that, including a PC version later. MDK was a game I was actually super hyped for, and I followed that very closely. It's actually one of my favorite PC games from that era, like ever. I think it's super interesting and also technically outstanding. And then, of course, I actually had a soft spot for Wild 9, but I do think it was a, you know, we'll get to that, but it's a little bit of a step down from MDK in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
I guess the other ones, like RC Stunt Coppers, one I didn't really spend much time with, but Messiah was definitely, if you were into the PC space, it got a ton of hype at the time for its, I guess you could say, like the technology they were using, right? Which is very,
tessellation.
Very
unique. Yeah. That was the magic word back then.
Very dynamic tessellation was the idea. And it didn't really work that well. But the game itself, it's pretty broken, but pretty interesting. And then, yeah, like I actually, looking at the list here, I guess I did play some of the other ones. I didn't love the Matrix stuff, but it was interesting. Sacrifice was good. But then the Golden Compass, that's, I didn't even realize that was Shiny. So
yeah,
I learned something new. So I'm excited really to see all of this stuff and talk about it.
They really go out with a whimper. And I think you said broken, but interesting. That really describes a lot of their output.
A lot of their output. Yeah. Yeah, big time.
And how about you, Stuart? You and Shiny Entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't played all of them before I came to do this, but Earthworm Jim, we've obviously talked about. MDK was pretty hyped back in the day, and I really enjoyed what I played of it. I've never gotten super far into the game, but I always think it looks and sounds and plays pretty great. And when I looked at it again today, I was like, yeah, this is a John Lindemann thing, I think. Like, he's going to have a lot to say about this tech.
I did a video on it.
Yeah, I've got to see that. Well, I might have seen that, actually. Yeah, Wild 9, I played the demo back in the day, and playing it for this was an interesting experience because I could see a lot more of the direct connections between it and Earthworm Jim. Compared to all the other games, I would say. And then, honestly, the rest of these I played for this, apart from some brief sojourns into the Matrix games, which I think are really interesting but very flawed, especially Path of Neo, which has something incredible in it, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, and as for me, I, of course, liked and played the Earthworm Jim games. And then a friend of mine had MDK, so I played a lot of that at his place on his Mac. And then I played the demo for Messiah, and I thought I might be done with Shiny. So I just kind of I removed them from my radar. Unfortunately, did not play Sacrifice, which seems like a really good game. We'll talk about it, of course. And then I was part of the gawkers who were looking at the failure of the Matrix games, everyone tearing them apart. And of course, John, you're talking about the era of big hype over PC games.
Oh, yeah.
That was really their time to shine, no pun intended, because with MDK and with Messiah, I think there were a lot of people who wanted to see them succeed, but there were also a lot of people who wanted to see them fail spectacularly. Like a lot of these big PC game designers with big egos, like John Romero and Peter Molyneux and what have you. Like David Perry was part of that crowd, seemingly, at the time.
The thing is, though, is like, I'm not sure if you guys have experience with it, but there was the tangent. A lot of the shiny guys, including Nick Brutti, split off to do Giant Citizen Kabuto in 2001 around then, which was outstanding. And that actually continued the legacy.
Yes.
I always considered that like a shiny game at heart. That's like, when you know what I mean?
That's blowing my mind, because I was coming into this and I was going to do Sacrifice. I'm like, oh, this is the game with the big topless booby blue lady.
Nope.
But that was Giant Citizen Kabuto.
That's Giants.
And that turns out to also be kind of a shiny game. Oh my god.
It is.
Yeah, and it's
Charlie Day in front of the diagram just freaking out right now.
It's actually why Shiny couldn't make MDK 2, because Nick Brutti was working on Giant Citizen Kabuto. Yep. So that's why BioWare, weirdly enough.
BioWare.
It's so strange. But so you mentioned that Nick... So, okay, we'll get into all the figures here. Nick Brutti was David Perry's partner in crime. David Perry is like the shiny guy. Nick Brutti spun off to make which developer who made that game?
It was like Purple Moon, I think it was called.
That sounds right. And then what I didn't mention is Doug Tenapple, a guy we love and admire. He went off and he made the development studio, The Neighborhood, to make a bunch of interesting looking games that are secretly about the Bible. We won't be talking about him, but he leaves Shiny to do his own thing and make, like I said, games that look really interesting. I'm not a huge fan of The Neighborhood or Skull Monkeys and then whatever else he did after that.
Indeed, although I secretly still like the original, The Neverhood, at the time, but it's pretty flawed.
I really like Skull Monkeys, but you know the guy, you know, the guy we don't talk about.
Oh, I say watch a Let's Play and then download the soundtracks, and you're good. I think for the
absolutely. For Christ's sake, don't play Skull Monkeys; you'll get very frustrated.
There's also a PlayStation version of that original The Neverhood, which is. Clayman.
Yeah. Don't forget Clayman Air Hockey or whatever it's called.
Oh, that gosh.
Incredibly obscure one.
All right. We should get to Shiny, though, right?
Yes. Yeah, no more Clayman.
Yes. Let's get to Shiny.
Clayman. The Bible. Again. Holy shit. Sorry.
Stuart, I think you're onto something, and I don't think you're just being a smartass. I think that was the intent.
Okay. Yeah, I know. No.
We're going to dig more into this in a future Neverhood episode. Probably. So let's move on to talk about Shiny, but let's go before Shiny to talk about David Perry, the key figure of Shiny. So we discussed this in our Earthworm Jim episode, but there were Shiny style games before Earthworm Jim, and that's all to thanks to a programming super genius named David Perry. So before he had his own studio, Shiny, he made his mark on the world with games, platformers that had flashy graphics, kind of slippery controls, and they all kind of felt and executed in the same way. Those games are Global Gladiators, Cool Spot, and Aladdin, the Genesis version. And of course, a lot of the people that helped him make these games would then move on to Shiny with David Perry when he forms that company.
I think of those games, Aladdin is the best of the bunch. I've always been of the opinion that the Super NES game is the superior game when it comes to Aladdin.
Correctly.
But Aladdin,
I think we're all on the same page,
is at least competent, where I feel like Cool Spot and Global Gladiators are just like nonsense. I think you've always kind of said like they have a bit of that airplane hangar syndrome going on, where it's just these big open spaces with lots of stuff to like collect, and it feels very aimless. I'm sorry, Stu.
No,
I heard that sigh. I'm sure you like it, but
I'm with you on Global Gladiators, but Cool Spot, I gotta say, like me some Cool Spot, but then again, I had it on the Master System, which is like a cut down, smaller scale version. Less annoying.
I never liked it, but Aladdin is okay, especially, I don't know if you guys played that enhanced version that was done for
The final cut. Yeah,
the final cut, which like fixes a lot of the camera problems and just makes it a more enjoyable game to play.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wasn't sure that they had edited it in any way or improved it in any way. Okay.
Yeah, there's like a new version where they've sorry, John. Well, not only did they fix a lot of the sort of tech issues, the collision issues as well, I think they've also added like new secrets and areas to the stages and just made it feel like a more complete, polished game. It's
significantly
really
better. And I think that was Digital Eclipse, which I found interesting because that's where Nick Brutti worked. works currently.
It's on the Aladdin and the Lion King Disney Classic Collection thing.
The Loin King?
The Loin King, yes. Well, you know, I was distracted by my DVDs.
Yes, yeah. John, you're totally right. He does work for that company, and we know Chris Kohler. I could have just asked for Nick Broody's email and gotten a lot of answers to these questions I had.
Right. Last year I was at their office with talking to Chris, and it's like, he's like, that's Nick Broody's desk. And I'm like, what?
Yes, a follow-up. We'll do a follow-up where it's like talking to Broody. But let's go back to David Perry here. So he is of that generation of UK-based computing wunderkinds that essentially was part of the programming scene. So he made a name for himself back in the day for writing programs and then sending them into magazines back when the code was small enough that you could have a magazine print your code and then have people then type their code into their computers and have a game. And I believe he was mostly writing programs for the Sinclair series of microcomputers. I think that was his bag
The UK.
Yeah, in the early 80s. And he made a name for himself as like a hobbyist programmer. And then before he turned 18, he was still, I guess, technically a minor. He moved to London, and this is where he works on games in a professional capacity. So he works on Spectrum ports of games like Konami's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Paperboy 2. But then he was eventually able to develop his own games with the previously mentioned Nick Broody. We can cover a few of these here just to give you a taste of like the general vibe of Perry, where I feel like looking at his games, looking at what he's into, he likes technical tricks. He likes getting the most out of hardware, and he is never content to stay with one kind of game forever. So that is why the output of Shiny and the output of Nick Perry is so varied over the years in terms of the kinds of games he likes to make.
Indeed. You can definitely see that in a lot of those games. And I think one of the ones that always still caught my eye even today is Savage.
Yes.
Which I feel Savage, like
Savage, 1988. So you can look up a lot of videos of the many different ports of this, which I guess it was a minor hit if it was ported so much or there was a demand for this kind of a game. But you play this big, beefy barbarian type. You blast enemies on screen with a lot of projectiles, weirdly enough. And it's just a game where things are constantly moving around on the screen. And then there are these levels that are essentially a ripoff of Space Harrier, a very popular game to copy at the time. And it's doing the best it can with that gameplay style on a Spectrum. Yeah. So really just like a bag of technical tricks with this game.
I played the Spectrum version myself, and I was impressed by the amount that he was throwing around the screen without... Well, I mean, obviously the colors are clashing and it's flickering. It's a Spectrum game. It's not like, you know, good, but you've got crazy amounts of stuff happening at all times. It's psychotically difficult, obviously. So I didn't get past like the first level, but I was able to play the Space Harrier one because I just loaded the second tape. I was very impressed by that. Hmm. It reminded me of, I think the game's called 3D Death Chase on the Spectrum, which is similarly impressive, but I also wasn't able to get past that. I sort of dodged these totem heads that were coming towards me for about 7 minutes, and I was like, when's this going to end? And it didn't. But I think it's something, it's a bit like one of, like, I don't know, like Battletoads and Double Dragon, and it's most impressive on the oldest sort of hardware because they're managing to wring that out of it. Whereas the version that's like on GOG, the PC version or the Amiga version, it's like, yeah, the Amiga can do this. So it's less remarkable, but it's still got some great stuff going on.
So one thing, Stu, that really stands out to me is you mentioned the color clash, but I was actually going to say compared to most specy games, it's actually really good at avoiding it.
Yeah.
Like the way they color the scenery and the individual items, like it manages to look far more colorful and yet not like noisy like a Spectrum game.
Yeah.
So they did a really great job there.
It's there. It's usually unavoidably there, but it is remarkable looking. It's one of the better looking and faster moving Spectrum games that I've seen.
But you mentioned the Amiga game.
Yeah.
And my goodness, do I love that version. It is so insane. It feels like a game that just... It's like the old, you know, the Bone Storm thing from The Simpsons. It really does feel like a game. It's just like you put the disc in it, it punches you in the face. It's just like screaming lyrics at you. Like the music is just like going to blow up your speakers. Like just stuff doesn't stop. You're just moving across the level. It's so ridiculous. And that makes it like weirdly delightful.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I'm glad you said Bone Storm because that was my idea in terms of how this game feels. It feels like a parody of video games that someone would make for a TV show in the early 90s. Like, aren't video games stupid and loud and violent? And there's a man in the background who keeps saying, Savage!
Savage! Oh, Savage! Savage. Yeah.
It was the Everybody Dance Now of barbarian video game music, that sample.
Dude, it's just... It's incredible, yeah, and it just goes. And it, yeah. It's honestly hard to believe that it even exists when you play it today. But I love
Their next game, Perry's next game, very, very different. Over here in the States or North America, it's called Overlord. In the UK, it had a much more provocative title, Supremacy, Your Will Be Done. And yes, I understand you don't want a game with the word supremacy when you're releasing it in America. I know the UK has got its own problems, but that title has very connotations here that are different. So, but this game is a space RTS with some stabs at what I would call 4X gameplay. It's not quite there, but like with a lot of shiny games I notice and a lot of David Perry games I notice, he's arriving to ideas before a lot of other people do, but does not have the hindsight to develop them in a way that's satisfying or that holds up today.
Yeah, this one, this is a tricky one, but it's fascinating because this is right around the time when like you were starting to see a lot more PC stuff, like play around with 4X strategy. I think Civ was out and big at that point already. I can't remember, actually.
Definitely around then, if the second one was like 92 or something. I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, no, Civ, I think, was actually 91.
Right.
But either way, like, yes, the PC was like the place for sort of strategy games like this. Computers, I guess I should say. What I didn't know is that apparently this received a port to the NES.
Yeah, a very late port in 93, and by the time this shows up on the NES, people have played things like SimCity and Dune 2 and other 4X-style games, RTS-style games, so this felt very dated, and the NES controller was not the best way to play it, so it reviewed pretty horribly.
It's so strange. One thing I will say about the name change, you know, I always love discovering these regional differences about what you can and cannot call something. As I discovered Victor Island's famous company, Spaz, only to learn that in the UK, after attempting to use it in a script for Digital Foundry, my boss was like, we don't say that here. I was like, wait, yeah. What do you mean? And then I figured it out. So
yeah, that's a bad one.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Yeah, I think we're basically all on the same page about that word between yes. the U.S. and the U.K. these days. Yeah, you guys arrived to it first. Yeah, these not back then, of course. I should have said name differences. Of course, David Perry worked on Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles.
Yes, right.
when he worked on that game.
Of course, TMN. Oh man, freaking in Japan, it was like Gekikame Ninja Den initially, mm-hmm. and then like nobody wanted to call them just straight up the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles out of the gate. So. But yeah, that's another topic.
We UK should be very on. Afraid of nunchucks, and they were right to be. Yes. But we've talked and about swords. Yeah, swords too. We talked about Supremacy, Overlord. We talked about Savage, and he goes on to work on some other games like the Genesis version of the Terminator, the first movie, that adaptation. This catches the eye of Virgin Games, who is the publisher for some of this work that Perry is doing. They recently opened a branch at the time in America, and they're like, David Perry, you are so good at making games so fast. We need a game about the McDonald's characters. Well, not necessarily McDonald's characters. We have the McDonald's license, and we're going to do a kind of sequel to MC Kids, but same characters, different kind of vibe, and that is one of the first things he works on in America. He flies over, and that's where he sets up shop, and that's where he gets to work on games for Virgin Games, like the ones we mentioned, Cool Spots and this one, Global Gladiators.
So my question about Global Gladiators is, like, a lot of brands at the time were very much into creating licensed games, right? Obviously, there was Cool Spot, there was the Noid, all that kind of stuff. But somehow McDonald's ended up with two games, right? Or two completely different games. You had this, but you also had, I think there was like McKids and other stuff as well. But then there was the Japanese Treasure-developed Treasure Land game, right?
Yeah, and for the Famicom, there was Donald Land, which is never came out over here.
So like, there's a ton of like random McDonald's games from all different developers, and I always wanted to know like who at McDonald's was driving this. Like,
yeah,
somebody clearly liked
it, I guess.
Because they couldn't put the food in the games. No. MC Kids had the characters. And then Global Gladiators has an interesting but very strange environmentalist bent to it.
Yeah.
Right. This was the era of Captain Planet and Awesome Possum.
Yeah, I mean,
like, these evil aliens are polluting the planet. Only we may pollute the planet. Destroy them.
With the amount of cows McDonald's goes through, I don't think they're really interested in saving the planet, but it was very trendy to hop on that bandwagon in the early 90s. And I guess
we never got a Mac Tonight game, though.
Oh, man.
We did get like Grimace's birthday game a couple of years ago. I will say about Global Gladiators, even though it's horrible, the music on the Mega Drive version is astonishing. It's like up there with Savage in terms of just what are you doing, like levels of obnoxiousness in a good way. I recommend it.
Yeah, I never played the Global Gladiators, but I do like MC Kids. It's weirdly good.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah. And so after David Perry's work at Virgin Games is complete, he goes off to establish Shiny. He decides, like, I don't want to go back to the UK. I want to stay in Southern California. Very odd. Very odd behavior. So we cover this in the Earthworm Jim episode, but with some funding from the toy company Playmates, Shiny is formed. Remember, Earthworm Jim is created to sell toys in a TMNT landscape. And then they name their company after the famous REM song, Shiny Happy People, which is, I think, the most Gen X decision on record to do that.
Yes, I agree.
So, John, you were not here for our Earthworm Jim episode. Do you have any thoughts on this? Because we're not going to cover these games in detail here. Go back to that episode. I believe it's a Patreon exclusive. But, John, like, what is your take on these games? You say you like them.
I do actually like them. And part of this might be, like, just having extreme... having played them a lot as a kid and essentially learned the game, I'm at the point where I can basically one CC the game, which is pretty nuts for Earthworm Jim 1, as it is quite a challenging game. But I initially played it. I played it mostly on Sega Genesis, but a friend of mine had the Super NES version. I remember noticing the lens flares in stage 1, by the way, thinking, wow, that's cool. But because of my obsession with this, I ended up buying it on... PC as well, because it got a really awesome, so it got two ports to PC, one from Activision, which is good, and then another from Rainbow, which had done like the Turrican stuff as well, and were involved with that. They did a DOS port of Earthworm Jim 1 and 2, and it, you mentioned that Playmates had this thing about toys. The DOS version of that actually included a specific EXE you could run that was literally just called Toy Show. And it would actually demonstrate all the toys for you on screen. It also had an EXE to show a video of the introduction and part of an episode, I guess, of the Earthworm Jim animated show.
Oh, very nice.
So they crammed all that in there, and it had great visuals. But I always thought it was an eccentric game with... difficulty being amped up by the focus on animation. But I felt like compared to Aladdin and prior stuff that Dave Perry had worked on, the actual level design, while complicated initially, at least perceptually, is actually pretty simple and like laid out in a more logical way. It wasn't airplane hangar style level design. It was like, all right, here's the path you take. And sometimes you have an upper path and a lower path. And once you master the mechanics, you can kind of really enjoy just like the vibes and the animation quality and everything that's going on and the weirdness. I will say I do think Earthworm Jim 1 is really good, but Earthworm Jim 2 is much less so, because this is a point where they became obsessed with like just cramming variety in there. Yeah. So there's like a million different mechanics. And I would actually say that DOS version of Earthworm Jim 2 is my favorite version, because they strip out some of the stuff.
They took out
the what is it? It's the Lorenzo soil stage, which is like one of the worst ideas for a second level.
I like that level, but it is weird that they mix it up early in the game.
It's okay, but it shouldn't be.
It's cool conceptually, but executing it just so arduous. I find it just takes so long.
There was also, I don't know, I'm sure you guys talked about it, but. And I picked this up as well eventually, but there's like the Earthworm Jim 2 for Saturn and also PlayStation, where they redid a lot of the graphics with like pre-rendered graphics, which is a horrible idea given the style of Earthworm Jim is meant to be hand animated cartoon graphics. They're like, ah, let's put some CGI in here. That'll work. That'll work. Mm-hmm. It does not work. But still, Earthworm Jim 1 as a whole, like music, gameplay, visual design, I think it's a really interesting and fun game. And in the end, the version I end up playing the most, weirdly enough, is the Sega CD version, Earthworm Jim Special Edition, which has some extra levels. It has the great CD music, and it's easy to pop into a Sega CD.
Yeah, it is really tragic how Shiny and a lot of other developers, where they're excelling at this 2D art, and then immediately they have to transition to the ugliest era of polygons known to man. I will say the art direction on Shiny games helps their late 90s games excel when it comes to overcoming just the general vibe of early polygonal games. But it is very tragic that they could never work in 2D again after letting go of Jim.
I know, right? Like, the 2D work was so good. But yeah, that's, you know, sign of the times. But at least their next game, MDK, which we're about to get to,
yeah,
is a stunner.
Yeah, and I have a certain fondness for, I guess, the voodoo 3DFX era of 3D graphics. But sure, I'm glad that, I mean, it was like impressive at the time, but it quickly got a little ugly to look at. I'm glad we arrived where we are now, but it just stinks to have to like let go of all of the lessons we learned about 2D animation and 2D game design, and then jump immediately to a new entire format entirely. Yeah, let's talk about MDK from 1997, mostly a PC game, although there was a PlayStation port. So how does Shiny follow up this very cartoony platformer series meant to sell kids toys in a TV show? Well, they create a third-person shooter that looks like an avant-garde music video, and it even ends with like a French pop song music video. And this was all intentional. Nick Broody and David Perry said they wanted to get as far away from Jim as possible, and they had been working on these cartoony games for like half of a decade. So here is the exact opposite. It's not a 2D game. There are, I guess, silly, cheeky elements to it, but it's pretty far from Earthworm Jim, even though you play a guy with a weird head in this one as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty far from it, but I mean, you've kind of got the same gun, you've got the same hovering sort of thing. It's not a million miles away, I would argue, but it's definitely distinctive.
It's interesting that when it was first shown off, even being called Murder, Death, Kill, even though they play around with what that means, they showed a 2D segment. I don't know if you guys saw that, but the initial reveal trailers for this actually showed like 2D pixel art, MDK action before transitioning to 3D, which I thought was fun because it gives you a taste of what it might have looked like, but ended up going 3D. I don't know when you want to get into it, but I have a lot to say about the technology and the style and what they're doing with this game that makes it so unique.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I do want to go over just the kind of general premise and how it plays. But
good idea.
You mentioned MDK. They were very cheeky, to use that word again, about the meaning of the title, but I guess it always was meant to evoke Murder, Death, Kill. But they could possibly have had a toy deal with this game, and the toy manufacturers did not want to put Murder, Death, Kill on the toy packaging, so they ran with MDK. Nick Broody did confirm that in a 2011 interview, despite the fact that they were always very vague about what it could have been. It's like, oh, it means everything, and it means nothing. It means whatever you want it to mean, essentially.
It's got to be Demolition Man reference,
oh,
for sure.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, without a doubt. But then, yeah, they played with it.
This is a third-person shooter in which you are playing a guy named Kurt Hectic. You're invading these alien ships, but first you drop onto them. So the first element of every stage is you skydiving down to the level, picking up power-ups along the way while avoiding enemy missiles. And then you do a lot of platforming, you do a lot of shooting, you do a lot of sniping. It is, like, we have not figured out a lot of the problems when it comes to 3D platforming and 3D games at this point, but it is very ahead of its time in terms of, like, it feeling very cool to play. And feeling like not as clunky as other games of the era.
Absolutely. And part of this stems from a very interesting and key decision they made. Kurt is a sprite, right?
Yeah, a very fluidly animated high-resolution sprite.
And that's so... Yeah, basically this is a third-person shooter at its core, but it's also just like a third-person everything game. It's constantly shifting what you're doing, each section of a map, and it's all broken up into these sections with these tunnels. The tunnels designed to give the game sort of a seamless feel, right? Where you're moving between each area, and you can have like... just the first level alone, you're going from like shooting bad guys, and then there's this giant open area where you're doing like a bombing run on a field. Then there's like sniping, there's underground sections. You know, it's just constantly shifting what you're doing gameplay wise, and they have a lot of unique like objects and such that. And this is where I guess the shiny humor comes out, and I like this about it. Like, the game is very dark and it feels serious and like not a good place, but there's a ton of comical elements that are just like weird. Like, I think, I mean, obviously there's the power up stuff, like the whatever they call it. It's like the blow up Kurt doll that you throw and the enemies are attracted to that, right?
Yeah.
But then there's that one level that opens where you like drop into what looks like a children's television show, like on the stage, and it's, but all the textures are like cartoony looking and intentionally, and you end up like knocking down the walls and there's like the stuff happening behind there, and they're just toy around with all these different concepts to create levels that feel exceptionally just different than anything that was happening at the time. And a lot of this is down to the technology. So they built a custom engine for this. It's also a game that requires a Pentium processor. I mentioned this in my video, but it's the only game I can think of where if you try to run this on a 486 PC, it will not work. It actually hasn't. It will just straight up throw an error message and say you need a Pentium. So I assume it has something to do with floating point operations or something that the 486 just can't do. And so it's also a game that runs initially, it was designed to run in software mode. It runs in 640 by 480. So basically four times the pixels of what consoles were doing at the time. So very, very sharp graphics. It can do wide open spaces with a mix of perspective correct polygon texturing. But, and this is what makes it really weird, they combine this with a lot of flat shaded polygons, right? Where they rely on big spaces that just have color. And you guys notice that, right? Where it's like not everything is textured.
Yeah.
And it's that contrast of texture with non-textured surfaces, plus like really dark shadows and strange colors that gives it a vibe that I think feels like unlike anything else out there.
I think the art direction, like even when it's a result to some extent of technical limitations. I mean, I feel it's bad saying limitations considering what they're doing here, but I think avant-garde is the right way to describe it. It's got an abstract sort of, I'm going to say it, I think it's got kind of an S&M vibe. Is that weird to say?
I think you're right on that. I mean, you wear essentially like an S&M suit,
yeah.
like kind of like a gimp suit, for lack of a better word.
And I always felt like this game, even though it's mostly kind of comical and the violence is quite OTT and abstract again, because the enemies don't really look like anything vaguely human at all. I always thought this game had kind of a dangerous atmosphere when I was younger. There was something about it. The opening of each stage where like the mine crawler, I think they're called, is absolutely destroying the surface of a planet as you parachute down to it. And then when you land, you're just in kind of like, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like nothing else. I literally cannot think of anything else that looks like this game that came out before it. It's just like this completely new world and experience.
I think part of it that actually really contributes to this, and I've always thought this is weird, but they deploy a technique that was made popular during the NES era. And by that I mean they use a lot of black space.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really unusual for a 3D polygon game, but there's a lot of spaces in this game where they just have a completely blank wall. There's no texture on it. It's just black.
Mm.
And then you have like high contrast colors. Like there's a room with these orange translucent platforms and windows out into the weird sky world. But the walls are mostly just pure black, except for like one of them. Right. And they do this all over the place, which gives it this like weird, shadowy, like difficult to comprehend design that I think is super evocative.
Yeah. The levels feel very big and they are very big, especially at a time when these 3D environments, they were either not big or they were big, but the game couldn't actually show you things beyond the fog wall. And this game relies a lot on sniping, and you have 100 times magnification scope on your rifle. So you can zoom very far across the level. And I feel like this game is arriving at things you'd be doing in third person and first person shooters a lot. So we have sniping, not the first game to have sniping, but the first game to really go all out with it, it feels like. We have things you would see in Fortnite and other games where you're dropping into a level first. And also, you can do airstrikes in this game, which is a common feature of things like Call of Duty. So, like, Perry and Broody and other folks, they're arriving at these ideas kind of first, and then other people will develop them with the better technology as it comes along. But we couldn't really do things in games until MDK, these specific things.
Absolutely. We also had, what do we want to call it, snowboarding, metalboarding. Mm. There's that stage where you're actually literally riding like a board down all these tunnels while shooting enemies that I always thought was super fascinating.
It was 97. Every game needed snowboarding. Even Final Fantasy VII had to have a snowboarding stage.
I feel like it's one of those games where it manages to be cohesive, but also it has that feel where everyone who's working on it is just super like, oh, and we could do this. We could do this. Put this in. Put this in.
Yeah.
It feels so works. Just alive with ideas the whole time.
Oh, it's one of the shiny games, and I think this is their general mentality, at least with these smaller development staffs. They would have one level designer per level. So, like, everybody, even though I'm sure they're talking with each other and meeting with each other, they're all, like, doing their own conceptual thing with each stage instead of just, like, all deciding together we're all going to spread the work around. So that's why you get such unique takes on levels, and some levels are better than others, of course.
And part of the reason this works, and one of the things they rely on a lot, is the platforming, right? Sort of. Which was very difficult to do at the time, 3D platforming like this. And what they did was you have the pre-rendered sprite, but they have a shadow below him that maps pretty well into the environment. Plus your, I don't know what to call it, ribbon cape, whatever it is, which allows you to essentially glide. So between the gliding and the shadow, it's actually pretty easy to figure out your position within the 3D world and engage in the platforming.
It helps that it's all pretty smooth. I mean, even the PS1 version is targeting 60, right? It feels like it.
No version targets 60.
Really? Mm.
But you got to remember, when this came out, like 30 frames per second, this targets a stable 30 FPS. And on most Pentium systems, it delivers. But like 30 FPS was not an easy thing to achieve in 3D at the time. And the PlayStation version is not that stable, and it's missing a bunch of like sprite data. But it was done by Neversoft, which is cool. You know, that would go on to do Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. But one interesting thing, though, is that this game was patched to support things like 3DFX Voodoo, but because of how the art was designed, it's actually worse. Huh. And the reason is those graphics cards, like the Voodoo, have a limit of the texture size that it can support. The maximum texture size is 256 pixels by 256 pixels. But MDK used 512 by 512 pixel textures in a lot of its environments in the software mode. So if you play in Voodoo mode, you got texture filtering and possibly smoother performance, but the textures were stretched out and blurrier, which is interesting. Hmm. And I maintain that this game is meant to be played without texture filtering. You just want those raw pixels.
Yeah, and we should mention this, and it seems obvious, but I do want to point out that the reason that they were going so crazy with this game in terms of creativity and just kind of anything goes is for 5 years, their lead platform was the Mega Drive /Genesis, and now they are working for the PC with the new Pentium technology. So suddenly, like, anything is possible. And they were kind of making anything become possible on the Genesis back in the early 90s. But now it's like, okay, we have just so many tools. We have so many technologies helping us. Like, what can we do with this? And I feel like MDK is just like, we're in this playground and we can just make any kind of fun ride for the player.
Exactly. In addition, one thing I want to mention is the music. I think that the soundtrack to this game is extremely good. It's very evocative, dark, marching music that's like super fitting to the game, but occasionally it goes into weird directions. Obviously, there's the ending bit, but there's other moments where it becomes like strange or silly, and sometimes there's sections where it's just pure ambiance. It's credited to Tommy Tallarico Studios, but it's likely the work of Joey Curris or Todd Dennis, based on what we know now. Either way, whoever did the music did a fantastic job. I would say.
Oh, we'll talk a bit more about Tommy Tallarico when we get to Messiah, which put that game back on the map. The recent, somewhat recent scandal with him and unveiling what he's actually done for the industry. So it seems like this game was kind of a hit for Shiny, or at least it established them, it reestablished them as, oh, now they are a cutting edge PC developer. Look what they can do. The people that made Earthworm Jim are now working in a new medium and doing new things. And it's a very nice example of late 90s cool, like, oh, cutting edge technology, very cool, like music video aesthetic. And I forgot about this, but the game Trojan Horse its way into many homes because it was one of two games that shipped with the original iMac in 1998. So that's why my friend had a copy. He got an iMac in high school and we were able to play MDK on it because it just was like, oh, what's one of the coolest games you can give Mac users? MDK. So I imagine a lot of the audience came from people buying this very popular version of the Mac, this very like user friendly.
That's so cool.
Yeah,
I didn't actually realize or remember that this had an actual Mac port, but that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's the one I played mostly, and it seemed fine to me. And we mentioned this, so this is available on Steam and GOG. And I guess MDK was popular enough to get a sequel, but by the time they wanted to make a sequel, Nick Broody, of course, is working on Giant Citizen Kabuto. So oddly enough, BioWare gets to make MDK 2, a game people like, and a game that did get an HD remake in 2012. I have never played this one, but I think there's a lot of fondness for it because it was a Dreamcast game.
Yeah, I bought it day one on Dreamcast, actually, and I did like it, but I've always felt that it's significantly less interesting than what Shiny did. Like, it's fun, it's funny, it's got good gameplay to it, but it absolutely lacks the sheer bizarreness of the original MDK, and the art direction just isn't even anywhere near close.
Yeah, you could definitely tell. Oh, go ahead, Stuart.
No, I was just going to say, I kind of pointedly avoided it because even seeing it, it just looked a bit like, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a bad thing, but it kind of looked like they'd kind of Pixar'd it a bit and they'd gone, let's make this a bit more conventional and more sort of like a comedy rather than this bizarre abstract thing that we got before. Maybe it's good. I should play it one of these days, but it's not Shiny, so I didn't for this.
Yeah, it felt like the original MDK was trying to be inscrutable in a cool way, but MDK 2 feels a little more marketable, based on the cover alone.
Exactly, and you really feel it. And they kind of go a bit more into the humor direction, but the humor in MDK 2 is like more direct, whereas in the original MDK, it's a little more abstract, I might argue. But the thing that's interesting is that, you know, BioWare wasn't necessarily an RPG first developer yet, right?
Like, yeah,
they did Shattered Steel, which was that voxel based mech game. Then they worked on Baldur's Gate as well. Around the same time was this MDK 2 thing, right? And it's really only after the gigantic success of Baldur's Gate that they kind of like essentially became an RPG developer.
Yeah, and I think by the time MDK 2 was being developed, the computer RPG was seen as, you know, not the best or most fruitful way to make money out of game development.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So are we okay to move on to the next game? Do you have any final MDK thoughts? It's a really cool game, and I think it does hold up. Obviously, a 1997 3D shooter / platformer is not going to be as user-friendly as you might want it to be, but I feel like it's like a very unique game that's worth playing.
I would say it's a game as well that's really, it's weirdly made for playing on a keyboard.
Yeah, definitely.
Great on a keyboard. Smacking that space bar to zoom it, you know, bring out the sniper view feels just good. And I really wish that this would receive like a Night Dive style re-release on modern platforms.
That would be nice. I mean, they remade MDK 2, so I feel like why not? Yeah. Why not remake MDK 2?
Right, exactly. Heck yeah.
going to move on to Wild 9, 1998 for the PlayStation. So this has Shiny heading back to more familiar territory. This is kind of like an Earthworm Jim spiritual sequel with a PlayStation edge to it. So we have a 2.5D platformer. So it's a 2D game, but with 3D graphics. And along with the standard running and jumping and shooting of Earthworm Jim, the main mechanic is the rig, which is essentially a bolt of plasma or like an energy lasso that lets you grab enemies, slam them back and forth, toss them around, and use them to solve puzzles within the environment. And it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting concept, but it feels like a lot of this is used in practice to create a lot of escort levels, which I feel like Shiny was very fixated on, especially in Earthworm Jim 2. I feel like that was their way to make the most out of a design level, like make you go through it as slowly as possible while following something else or having something follow you.
Yeah, it's a game that, in, as well as the sort of escorting stuff, which there's one in the second level, which is just, it's annoying because the rig, the thing you use to move this guy through the stage, it just isn't reliable enough to get him where you want, and you're going to drop him, and you're going to have to repeat terrain. But also, the game is really fixated on making you do things three times.
Hmm.
Like, to destroy certain things, you need to put three enemies into them. And it's like, why? I'm not doing anything interesting. I'm just going back a bit, getting an enemy, returning, and shoving them into a mincer. Is shoving enemies into a mincer fun? Yes. Yes, it is. We've all played Resident Evil 9. But it's just not that fun in this. I wish I liked it more than I do, because I love the grungy look of it. I love the music that's in there.
Oh, yeah.
But it gets old quickly, basically.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you, Stu, where I like this game, and I actually liked it back in the day. And I probably have increasingly fond memories of it only due to playing this at the beach back in the day, because I used to bring my PlayStation down to Florida. It's like swim in the morning, PlayStation in the afternoon. And I played Wild 9 down there. And I liked it a lot, but I always felt it was a bit slower than I might have liked. And I do remember there being like a ton of tutorial pop-ups, which I found kind of like infuriating back then. Because like you look at their older games, and it doesn't really have anything like that. You just figure it out. And this game's like constantly like, here's a box. Like, hey, dude, here's how you do this thing.
Yeah, if you look at the box art, really big on the cover, it says, torture your enemies. And as a reminder to people out there, that's back when torture was cool in the late 90s. But
of course,
that gave me the idea like, oh, I bet you can do a lot of like sick, weird stuff in this game. But I couldn't play this for the podcast. But watching a Let's Play or a playthrough, I thought, oh, not really. You mostly just like kind of bam enemies back and forth to kill them, or sort of like toss them around. That's the extent of this kind of energy.
I mean, lasso. Spinning fan blades you can throw them into,
set them on fire and stuff. It's just once you've done it a few times, it's kind of like. I mean, the one novel thing I do like is when you want to get across a spike pit, you can slam enemies into it and use them as platforms. And every time you jump on them, they like twitch, and it's horrible. But it is at least kind of amusing and gameplay thing.
My thought was always that the torture your enemies bit came from a marketing department.
Yeah. Oh,
the
for
way
sure.
That John Romero is going to make you his bitch did, which was like this edgy marketing at the time.
You
but like,
you do get a torture score at the end of each level. That's to be said.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't fit.
I guess the marketing made me think it'd be more like Deception, that series where you're like setting a bunch of traps and finding more like creative ways to bounce an enemy around. But no, it is just like sort of like Bionic Commando, even down to like the swinging around, which Jim also did in Earthworm Jim 2, I believe, in Earthworm Jim 1. So I can see a lot of similarities here. The biggest issue for me is that there are interesting design elements in this game, but working at this level of resolution with this many polygons, I feel like Shiny could not really convey that with the PlayStation's hardware. Like they could with MDK. Like with MDK, I feel like all of their visual ideas were coming through loud and clear.
Yep.
Here, it feels like there's like a layer between you and what they want to show you that is kind of just getting in the way.
Yeah, you can see what they're trying to do. I think the backgrounds are quite beautiful, and the art and texture work is pretty detailed for PlayStation, but it just doesn't quite resolve. I will say it's better than the non-Shiny game that was probably released around this time, Earthworm Jim 3D.
Oh. Mm. Yes.
Which took their old IP and turned it into something really bad.
We did talk about that, and that's a game where I could only I bought it like for $10 at a on a you know clearance sale, and I thought I got ripped off at $10.
Yep.
I don't even want to finish the first level.
Nope.
No. I do think that it's playing it today briefly. I thought it was interesting that you could still see the design ideas from Earthworm Jim sort of evolving in this. But I mean, was there Tenapel art in this as well? It really looks like his art. Because like the guy, the tutorial guy, it looks really a lot like Peter Puppy to me. And the swinging is very Earthworm Jim. The energy that you collect looks a bit like the suit powers that you get in Earthworm Jim. And part of my brain was going, was this once an Earthworm Jim game? Is this a proto for Earthworm Jim 3 or something?
Doug was not involved with this.
No, he wasn't. Should be noted
at all.
Well, someone who really, really wants to buy his Style Wars. So that's cool.
Unfortunately, you know who was involved? John Alvarado.
No, I don't even know who that is. Does he suck as well?
Was he? I think he. If it's the same John as I'm thinking, he was involved with, the Intellivision Amico.
Okay. Yes. Oh, boy. Oh, no wonder it all goes back to Earthworm Jim.
It does.
All right.
Well, yeah, that's Wild 9. This game was very panned at the time, which is why I never even rented it back when it was.
I feel like that's. Oh god, that's a little unfair. And I suspect that the reason it was so panned actually has less to do with the game's quality and more with like it's a 2D platform.
Yeah, I think so too.
And Klonoa was also not well received, and the reason it's so rare is it didn't sell at all. Nobody cared. So like platformers were not the hot thing.
Yeah,
I will say one embarrassing and silly thing about this game. I'm going to admit it here first. When I went to see Video Games Live, the show that Tommy Tallarico put on, like in, I don't know, 2006 or 7 or something, I had him sign my Wild 9 manual.
Unfortunately, John, it's not gone down in value.
Yeah.
I know.
It's appreciated in value.
I'm sorry.
Are you sure it was even really him who signed it?
he gave it to a subcontractor to sign it for you, who was really good at copying his signature, I will add.
But hey, at least I had the I brought my Mass Effect manual and had Jack Wall sign that, and that's some good music.
Well, it was brave of you to admit that here. We won't hold it against you.
I finally had to come out, you know.
So we're going to move on to a lesser known game by Shiny, RC Stunt Copter, 1999 for the PlayStation. And this is really the most obscure Shiny game outside of their last one, probably.
Yeah.
And this does feel like a real one for us game, even though most of Shiny's games feel like a one for us game, because Perry had a very personal interest in RC copters. And he felt that, oh, this DualShock, this is the best way to control one in a video game. And a lot of guys want to do this hobby, but they don't have the money because it's an expensive hobby. Here's a way for you to partake in this expensive hobby in the comfort of your home by buying like a $30 or $40 PlayStation game.
I played this today, and I thought it was much, much more difficult than flying an actual remote control helicopter. I did like it. I think there's a lot of character to it, like the voiceovers and some of the music, which is actually lifted from Earthworm Jim, or at least arranged from Earthworm Jim, which really fascinated me. But basically, once you've cleared the tutorial, it just immediately becomes psychotically difficult. It's very hard to control this thing, which is by design, I'm sure, and there's something satisfying about that, but it's not the kind of thing I can see myself going back to, really.
They tried to make it control as much like a real RC copter as possible, and I think that might have been a mistake, but if you want a real RC simulation, I guess this is where you go to. It was the only place to go. And I found a quote from Perry in an issue of Next Generation that was hyping up this game, and Perry says, quote, "I decided to do fly-by-wire." By the way, fly-by-wire was the working title for this game. Continuing, "in order to prove that new genres of games can be developed, and all that crap about it has to be like Doom, or it has to be a fighting game, is not only wrong, but just an excuse for companies to keep feeding us the same old stuff." So that does feel like he's not just talking about this game, but he's talking about like the ethos of Shiny in general. We're not going to do the thing you expect from us until The Matrix comes along. Then give me the money. I'll do that.
Yeah, this is... it's not a game I've spent much time with, but at least the tech looks interesting. It runs at a pretty high frame rate, and they're doing some fancy texture stuff at points that I thought was pretty interesting. But it's very not Shiny.
Yes.
So he lives up to his mission. He has accomplished it.
Whenever I look at Shiny's gameography, I'm like, oh, right, this one. And it does feel like very non-Shiny. There's like a laid-back Owen Wilson-style guy as the announcer for the game who's very charming. And this game came out at the wrong time completely, because September of 1999, the biggest month in gaming history, many magazines said. It's the launch of things like the Dreamcast and Final Fantasy VIII and many other big titles. An RC stunt copter game is going to get lost in the shuffle, and this one certainly did. I assume that it's very rare because nobody bought it.
Yeah, it's probably about right.
And yeah, that is RC Stunt Copper. Let's move on to another game by Shiny, Messiah 2000. So like I said up front, the early aughts were about a lot of like notable PC gaming personalities with big egos falling flat on their faces with ambitious titles that are going to fall far short of their mark. This is one of the big ones. And I think thanks to the H-Bomber guy, Roblox Oof video, I think that video made people remember what Messiah even is, because this is the origin of the oof sound that you might know from Roblox if you are younger than us, let's say.
Or have a kid.
Or have a kid, too. You can legally know about it if you're younger or if you have a kid.
Exactly.
And yes. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, John. I know you played this for Digital Foundry within the past couple of years. I check out that video you put together.
Oh, yeah, like the Let's Play thing I did. Yeah. No, I actually both played this back in the day and then later sort of revisited it again for that little video where I opened up a new copy and installed it on a proper retro PC. And as you know, Bob, this was hyped up for one weird thing, tessellation.
Mm-hmm. And finally, a playable character named Bob. I was waiting for that for a very long time.
Yeah, that's true. Bob the Angel. That's true. It finally happened. little cute cherubby angel.
Possibly inspired by the dancing baby meme. We don't know. But yeah, tessellation, John. If you look at the Next Generation cover story about Messiah from, I think, 1997, very little of that cover story is about the game and what you do in it. Most of it's about tessellation and the technology they're using to power the game. But please continue.
So what's interesting... tessellation is the idea of just sort of like altering a polygon mesh to like add additional complexity dynamically to it in a way to sort of like increase the mesh complexity as it gets closer to the camera. This is actually something that would be really common, weirdly, on the PlayStation 1. Like that's how you would defeat texture warping to a degree, is they actually had to like increase the complexity of the mesh near the camera. But Messiah's promise, from what I recall, was that they would dynamically alter the stuff based on your intended frame rate target and your PC specs. The idea was that no matter which PC you ran it on, the complexity of the visuals, the characters especially, I believe, would change. The problem is it didn't really work that well. Like it resulted in characters that looked very warbly and strange to begin with. And secondly, performance on a period appropriate PCs was not good. Like compared to MDK, which ran really well, this was like kind of a mess out of the gate. I remember struggling big time to get smooth frame rates in this game. I think I was probably running a 733 megahertz system at the time, possibly. Either way, not super smooth, but still it looks very Y2K.
Yes.
Wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's similar to MDK. The main character is a very smoothly rendered sprite with a lot of frames of animation. And the premise of this game, it's very vague. You play an angel named Bob. You're sent to this dystopian Earth in order to, you know, cleanse it of sin. And the gameplay involves jumping into the bodies of both hostile and friendly NPCs in order to solve puzzles with their unique actions. Most of the time, they are just keys that will open doors. And if anyone sees Bob in his true form, a naked little angel, they will try to murder him. So you're in your weakest state when you are in angel form. And I guess depending on the difficulty, that will determine how hard it is to jump into another body. I think if on the hardest difficulty, you have to jump in from behind the enemy or the NPC.
That's right. It's actually a very interesting mechanic, I think, because it is essentially an action puzzle game, right? Where you're just going through these worlds and trying to figure out, almost stealth-like, like, how do I actually proceed here? How do I get through this section? And it usually amounts to finding the right dude to possess and utilize them to get through it. And of course, there's like scientists, there's combat guys you can possess, all these different types of characters. And that's what you got to do. Problem is, though, is like it also has a lot of like weird fiddly platforming. You can die very easily. It's a game where you kind of you'll be manually bringing up the menu and hitting save like a lot because it's very trial and error.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I would love to say more about this, but I have this on GOG, and this game does not work. I managed to get it working for like 20 minutes, and when I left the game and came back to it, it no longer worked anymore. So there are fixes out there, but good luck getting this one running. You know, I had big problems, and I couldn't find like a repack or something that just did it for me. So good, I don't know, rough times.
This game, though, the premise is fascinating to me, and I wish the way it executed was much better, because you have this idea of, okay, jump in anybody, solve puzzles, and it seems great, but I feel like they didn't have time, or they couldn't think of anything more interesting to do than, you know, using certain people to open certain doors, shooting, and a lot of platforming. And this might be an unfair comparison, but I think something like the modern Hitman games are a much better version of this. I mean, obviously they look better, absolutely. But those games are all about, okay, who do I need to become in order to solve this puzzle within the environment? And of course, the modern Hitman games have the advantage of coming out like 15 years after this with a lot more technology at their fingertips and much bigger staffs to work with. But I think like that is the ideal version of what Mystia was establishing.
And I mean, Hitman 1 actually came out in the year 2000 as
well. That's right, yeah.
So, and that is essentially the same idea. It's about utilizing characters in an environment to like get past obstacles and puzzles, except for Hitman doesn't have like platforming and stuff like that.
I do wish I could have played more of this, because what I did get to play, I thought seemed really kind of up my street. It's odd. It's grungy again. I think it's got Fear Factory music in the soundtrack as well, which is really cool.
And boy, does the game's logo scream that kind of era for music good. As well.
When I got that running, I was so hyped. I was like, finally, this insane logo just like bursting music at you. I was very excited about that.
I
wish Nightdive would do this as well, but there's no game I wish Nightdive wouldn't do. So.
Yeah, I agree. I would love to see this sort of like remade and polished up somewhat, just to like fix its issues. But I think like you kind of insinuated, Bob, compared to something like MDK, I just don't think the ideas here are as well executed.
Yeah.
They didn't have the creative juices to power through all the way to the end.
And this didn't get a console port, right? It was going to get one, I think, or it was announced or something, but...
It was PC only, and I think it was, because it was a failure, it did not come out on anything else. Was it... There may have been... I feel like this... I recall this being announced as a Dreamcast game at some point.
Yeah, I think there was a planned Dreamcast port at some point. This sold very poorly, though, for the PC.
Yeah, it sold poorly, and it probably wouldn't have run that well on Dreamcast.
Yeah.
There is a funny comparison, though, a thing to note is that one of the composers for this, beyond Joey, of course, from Tommy Telleriger Studios, was Jesper Kidd.
Oh.
Who would become known for his amazing work on the Hitman series. So he worked on both Hitman and Mysia, and weirdly enough, MDK2, all in that same year. So the dude was on fire at the time, and obviously would continue to ramp up and do like incredible music in time.
Yeah, these are good soundtracks. And we keep bringing up the era of the big PC game developer with the big ego, and that's essentially what's going on with Perry at this era, because there's that Next Generation cover story. I did read it. He's got a big ego in that. I'm paraphrasing here, but he essentially says like, game developers that can't do what we're doing are just lazy. Things like that, that are angering people. And then you keep hearing Mysia coming up in the press at the time as, it's going to be the next big game. This game gets delayed for 2.5 years. It is originally a Q1 '98 game that gets pushed into the end of the year 2000. And I think everyone was just rooting for the downfall of David Perry and Shiny. And of course, the game cheekily titled Mysia, it's meant to evoke like, this is the second coming of video games. Like, Christ is coming back to Earth and he's bringing you Mysia. Yep. So they were kind of setting themselves up to fail here, I guess, with a game this bold that they clearly did not fully, they pulled it out of the oven a lot too early, even though it was in there for 3 years, 4 years.
I, interesting, this was also the year, I believe, of Daikatana finally coming out.
Yeah.
And I actually think Daikatana is quite a good game once you patch it up. But at launch, it was pretty rough. But I always thought about this, the rock star developers of the 90s and like what that resulted in. But then you look at like John Romero today, and he's just like one of like the coolest dudes in the industry, like super kind, super just an amazing guy. And I've always wondered if like his sort of like brush with fame and then being swatted down back to earth in the late 90s ended up sort of making him the person he is today. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Some of them made it out the other end okay. Some of them are Cliffy B.
I mean, it comes and goes, you know. But I haven't kept tabs on Dave Perry other than I know he went and did stuff with like Meta on VR. VR work was awesome.
Yeah.
It was going great though, Stu. That's the problem. And then Mark Zuckerberg's just like, fuck this. We're done with it.
Well, I have a little coda to this that will let you know where David Perry ended up. It's not like something I personally wish he was doing, but we'll talk about that when we talk about like post-show stuff. Cool. So yeah, that is Messiah, a very rough game. And then we get the last real shiny game in 2000 alongside Messiah as Sacrifice. So this is an RTS, so it's sort of like their jump from Savage to Overlord. Like, let's do something completely weird and different. Let's go back to our roots in a way. And this is inspired by an old Spectrum game where wizards battle each other, too. So they're really drawing from their past game development. And this is an RTS. It's all about combat. There's no base building. Instead, it's an all-out wizard battle that involves micromanaging troops. And then the sacrifice can be found in how you reap the souls of enemies in order to generate more of your own troops. So this is essentially Pikmin a year before Pikmin. And that is my that is my argument here.
I'm not like an RTS guy, but I played this a little bit, and it reminded me very much of Brutal Legend, the way that you manually control your guy while sort of ordering your folks around, though it does have a more traditional RTS, or, like drag a box around all your bros and then
suddenly Army Corps of Hell for PS Vita.
Oh, yeah.
No, actually, I do have something to say about this, because this is, I believe, a continuation of what was briefly known as the Straction genre, the strategy action genre. And this was something that was really popular during this period. And it was kind of started by a game called Uprising from 3DO of all companies. And then Activision did Battlezone, which was utilizing the old 80s IP to create a new game. And what made these unique and quote unquote Straction is that you would control a unit, and that unit could engage in actual like action, right? You could battle, you could like engage with the environment, you're running around either first or third person, but you're also commanding units, so it basically puts you on the battlefield. And that was a big difference from like the typical overhead RTS games, and I really liked this idea, especially Battlezone 1998. It's just a really awesome game because you can climb into any unit, any vehicle, and take charge of it while also ordering things around. And Sacrifice is very much that sort of thing. And also Giant Citizen Kabuto, which is being made at the same time by Nick Brody and crew, also has a lot of Straction elements in it. And yeah, obviously you mentioned Brutal Legend, Army Corps of Hell as well. Like it still sometimes exists, but this command the units while, directly controlling the character. Pikmin as well, obviously. Yeah, it's a really cool idea, and I think Sacrifice is actually a pretty good game, and it's underrated, I would say. Yeah. Given
I like the humor that's laced through it. It's very very shiny, basically, and the graphics, again, it's not as grungy, but it does still have that same vibe, and I appreciated that about it.
Yeah, maybe it's just how the game looks and the fantasy vibe to it and the sense of humor. It reminds me a bit of a Bullfrog game. Like if Bullfrog were to make an RTS, this is how it would execute, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Magic Carpet's kind of a Straction game, right? In a way, as well.
In a way, yeah, you're right. That's a good point.
And this is another shiny game with a very long development cycle. So it was originally worked on by a team of four people. That, of course, ballooned over time. But screenshots for this one were in magazines as early as 97. And like Messiah, the game comes out in late 2000. So this one is stewing in development for a while. It's not incredibly strange for a game to be in development that long at that time period, but it seems like they were having development issues within Shiny with these two big games sort of coming out side by side in the year 2000.
Absolutely. But you're right. So this kind of is like the end of classic shiny, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess people look back on it fondly. People didn't really know how to take this when the game came out. Like, we're not sure what you're doing here. We kind of like it. And now if you look at what are the best 100 games on PC, this will normally be on that list within like the 80 to 90 range. People do look at this fondly, thinking like it was ahead of its time. We didn't give it a chance. This is the last real shiny game. So I think it is now viewed in those terms. Like, they kind of had something here.
Exactly. Exactly. People didn't realize what they had at the time. And they certainly didn't see what was coming.
No.
Next.
Yeah. And again, this is another one of the, I wanted to play this one again. I think I played it back in the day, like a demo or something, but on Steam, it's like $25. And it did not go on sale in the spring sale that's happening now. So I don't know what's happening. I don't know who owns these games, but I'm going to say settle down, please.
Yeah. It's, I mean, they were, Interplay had these, right? Because they've gone now, right? Or they've been resurrected or something. But I know that when I bought that Sacrifice and Messiah on Good Old Games, they were something like £2.50.
Yes.
So they are not that anymore.
Okay, it is on sale.
I mean, if you want to spend £16 on a game that doesn't work, Messiah, you know, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I was able to run Messiah 15 years ago on my old PC. I don't know if it would run now, but the important thing is, Stuart, I also paid like $3 for it. So, my nose. Let's move on to the final era for Shiny, their third act, as it were. So we have Enter the Matrix, a year 2000 game for all the major platforms of that era. So in a way, they're stooping to making a licensed game, but this is a great opportunity for the studio because the original The Matrix was seen by Warner Brothers as a weird movie that was probably going to fail. They had no idea it was going to be this like this gigantic hit for them that would influence culture for decades to come, which is why the original Matrix did not have any merchandise or any tie-in video games. They were not prepared for what it would become. So that's why all of the focus on merchandising is put on the sequels. And that is why Shiny is then hired to make the next, the first Matrix game, which is announced at E3 2000. The perfect time to announce your Matrix game. We're all waiting for those sequels. And Shiny is going to make an essential part of the Matrix story. It's not going to be an adaptation of the games. It is going to be a part of the larger story with individual cinema sequences that are filmed by the Wachowskis. So there are about 42 minutes of this game that are original movie-style cutscenes filmed in live action with characters from the films.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to hold my hands up here and say I really like The Matrix. I'm well aware of the flaws and the reception, but I think I love the Wachowskis, and I think that they got a vision, and I respect that. I like this game because of that, but it is a hot mess to play. It's cool. There are cool things in this game. I do like the way the combat does genuinely feel quite dynamic. I was playing it today, and I noted at one point, I had an enemy swing a kick at me, and the character actually grabs the leg and swings them around into the wall, and all I'd done is hit grab, and it's like, wait a minute, you knew, it's not just like a kind of a, I don't know how to describe it, like just a dialed-in grab. I grabbed the enemy with the way they were attacking me, and I thought that just seemed really cool and dynamic, but then obviously the camera went to shit, so I don't know what happened after that.
Yeah, so this, you mentioned you know, the idea of making another licensed game, right? Something Dave Perry was certainly no stranger to, as we know. Mm-hmm. But this was, because of the direct involvement of the Wachowskis, kind of like a unique opportunity for them. And I do understand why they went for it. It sounds like the Wachowskis actually wanted to work with them. Though I think they also talked to Konami at some point. But basically, they wanted to make a video game. And Shiny ended up being the one that got picked. They became the one.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't mean to be dismissive when I said they stooped to making a licensed game because...
Sure.
No, we get what you mean.
We get exactly what you mean.
The Wachowskis did not intend for this to be just another licensed game. They were trying to elevate the idea of the licensed game by saying this is not just a toy tied into the releases of our movies. This is an essential part of the story. So, and at the time, Shiny was viewed at the as like, oh, this cutting edge, cool developer that makes like weird, interesting things. They fit the vibe of the Wachowskis perfectly, especially something like MDK exactly. is on par with the Matrix in terms of like, what are all these weird ideas I've never seen before?
But my guess, and I don't know all the history here of this, is that the fact that it needed to be tied into the movies probably hurt the project pretty badly, because it's clear that Shiny often needed a little more time to get their games done, especially during these years. And I feel like this is a game that still needed to ship around the time of the films in order to, you know, complete the whole marketing thing. And because of that, it ended up in kind of a state. They also had to ship it on many platforms on day one, which is something they didn't normally do. In fact, up to this point, I'm not sure they ever did any sort of like massive multi-platform release.
No, I guess so Earthworm Jim, but that's still only like two or three platforms, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that did get ports, but it wasn't always ported by them. And at first, it was those two, right? So, but this was like all the current platforms and the PC. And it had a lot of weird tech things. I will say on the tech side, it was one of those rare Xbox games that supported 1080i, which is like was unusual. And that I always remember that being one of the talking points and something I tested when I finally got an HD set. It's like, oh, you can play this in HD. But compared to the other games that they had worked on, it's very rough. The visuals are not great. The frame rate's all over the place. It's got a lot of strange things going on that just feel super unpolished and janky.
Yeah.
So even though there is cool stuff in here, it's also really rough.
It's, I mean, the level design as well, a lot of it is just identical empty offices that you
like Oni.
It's crazy. I will say, like, I did like the hacking mini game that's in there. There's like, you can access like a kind of a prompt and you can do a little rudimentary kind of mini game by figuring out sort of passwords and unlock some features that way, which is cute. I think you can even plug a keyboard in for it, which is fun. But if you want if you are a Matrix head and you want to experience the story in this game, all the footage is on the box set, like the Blu-ray set and the DVD set of the Matrix game. So you do not need to, play the game.
I'm glad it's been.
And I honestly wouldn't recommend that you do.
I'm glad it's been liberated.
I don't know, man. I feel like it might be worth playing just because it's so weird. If you're a fan of historical curiosities, it's worth checking out.
Yeah.
Especially because they do try to mix up genres in there. They got like rail shooting sections, car sections, all kinds of weird little different areas throughout the game.
Yeah, it's not like it's difficult either. You can
get through it pretty easy. Yeah. Now the PC version. I actually did a video with my colleague Alex once where we looked at the out-of-the-box PC experience versus like PlayStation 2 and the PC version of this initially. And this actually made the game famous for a little bit. Had serious problems with how it would draw its geometry in some scenes. Famously, the car had square wheels, if you've seen that floating around. And it looks hilarious.
Yeah, I don't think this is available today in any way, I guess, because of licensing. And I will say, unfair and unfortunate, but Shiny announces this game in, I guess, June of 2000. And then between that announcement and the release, a game called Max Payne is released. That is the Matrix game. And when I'm watching footage of this game, I'm like, I should play Max Payne again. That was fun.
Yeah.
I know they were biting into what the Matrix had offered in 99, but they just did it better by ripping it off before they could release the, you know, the sincere licensed version of the Matrix. So it's too bad for Shiny on that one.
To be fair, though, Max Payne is pure gunplay.
Yeah.
Whereas Enter the Matrix has like a lot of like martial arts stuff as well.
Yeah, it's a very sloppy, unfortunately unfinished game. But when you hit focus and you run up to an enemy, hit the kick, and your character actually pivots off a bit of scenery and kicks them in the face, it is badass. I gotta say, it is badass.
Yeah, this game really ripped into by the press for being buggy, seeming rushed and unfinished. Yeah. And their big problem was like, we can't play as Neo, the coolest guy in the Matrix, or the guy who's the hero of the Matrix. And that problem, I guess, is solved in The Matrix Path of Neo, a 2005 video game, which is a more by-the-numbers licensed game. they're not providing you an behind the scenes look at the Matrix or an essential part of the story. Essentially, they're saying, here are some key Neo moments. We're going to let you play them. 2 years after the movies come out, when I think everyone had really turned on them. Now I think they're being reevaluated, but this is a peak era of we hate sequels and prequels. You've ruined everything we've ever loved. Yep. And people were not ready to receive this game, I think, in 2005.
And that's a shame, because this game is bonkers. Mm-hmm. And it's also a return to form for Shiny in terms of the tech. Like, they are doing some awesome stuff with this game's like technology, especially on PlayStation 2. Like, famously, this is one of the only, like, possibly only game that they try to simulate like per pixel lighting and bump map textures and such in certain scenes that you just, the system just can't normally do. It has a lot of cool like visual effects and reflective surfaces and just all kinds of neat stuff. And I think it's such a big leap from Enter the Matrix on that front, at least the presentation side.
I mean, I'm sorry, but I really want to talk about the ending.
Oh, please do. Okay? Stu, it has an infamous ending sequence, and I did fast forward to the end of a playthrough.
Before you talk about that, just note that most of the game is it's following the movies, right?
Yes, that's right. And you're doing sort of, as you mentioned, both of the greatest hits, more or less. Mm, it's
exactly. Yeah. And so that means the gameplay is constantly shifting. Like, there's points where it's like, oh, now you're Neo, like going through the cubicles, trying to get out of the building on the phone with Morpheus, right? And it's totally different gameplay from like some other section where you're like doing kung fu and all that. But then the ending.
Yeah. Now, if you'll remember in The Matrix Revolutions, they have what I believe is called the Super Brawl, which is essentially Goku and I don't know, Cell. I don't watch Dragon Ball. I don't know what happens in that. Smashing against each other over and over again. And what happens in this game is when that scene is about to take place, it sort of stops and zooms out into like a sort of a white void. And I'm probably misremembering this slightly, so do Google it or whatever. And you've got representations, pixel art representations, like really small, like Atari style of the Wachowskis. And they stop and they say, like, essentially, well, that ending wouldn't really work for a video game. It wouldn't, like, really have the sort of climactic feel that we want. So we've devised this completely new ending. And then what happens is the Agent Smiths all merge into this giant, like, kind of Godzilla Mega Smith thing that then reaches over to a advert for sunglasses that he then takes the massive pair of sunglasses off and puts on his own giant kaiju face. And then you beat the shit out of him, and the Queen's song, We Are the Champions, plays when you beat him.
You know?
It is unbelievable. And I mean that in a good way. It's so cool and meta and interesting way to end the game.
You know, Stuart,
and more people should see it.
I have not actually ever watched the Matrix 2 and 3 movies, and because of this, the ending of this video game, I assume that was the ending of the third movie. You're telling me it's not?
No, it's not at all.
Okay.
No.
Darn it.
Yeah.
Now I probably won't ever watch it. sorry, go ahead, Stuart.
I was just saying, I guess you got to watch them.
Yes, eventually. It's something I'm missing in my life. I need to know what those movies are really about. The riff tracks will not make a difference in my life. I need to sit down with the real thing.
I love those movies. I love them.
Any other final thoughts on this one before we move on to the Chinese final game? A very weird final game.
I just think that this is actually really worth revisiting right now, mm-hmm. just to just to see what they were trying to do at the time.
It's leagues better than Enter the Matrix, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks great.
It absolutely looks great. And I actually really suggest checking out the PS2 version specifically, because they do things on that console that you just normally don't see there. Mm-hmm. So it feels like a sign-off for Shiny saying, yeah, we still got some technical chops. Check it out.
Yeah, I think it helped them that they weren't living in the period that was leading up to the most anticipated sequels of all time. And they also had a roadmap for the kind of thing they would be making when they're just adapting existing scenes from the film. So I think that really helped them out a lot with this game. Now we're going to move on to a weird final game for a studio, and that is The Golden Compass, which was an adaptation of the famous children's book. I always confuse this with Narnia, but Narnia is the Christian one, and The Golden Compass is the atheist one. So important distinction there. And I really have not much to say about this, except it seems to be a much worse version of Enter the Matrix in terms of just trying a bunch of 3D action game ideas and not all of them sticking. And this one is also coming out for a lot of platforms, and I think Shiny is behind all of them, even the DS one, although I could not find much about the DS version, to be sure.
I didn't try the DS one. I tried this on PS3, and it kind of just made me sad because it's such a generic licensed movie tie-in game. Now, admittedly, I only did the first 20 minutes or so. Admittedly, maybe it turns into something like Guitar Man or something, but it was just the most generic, obvious go, like run along a corridor, swipe at some enemies that don't put up any kind of resistance. When you've got your bar full, press circle, do a special attack. And it just kind of is like it's just kind of sad for a shiny game to be so uninspired in any way. There's nothing in there that mechanically that made me go, "Oh, that's interesting." It's the same as all of the other licensed games that aren't even necessarily terrible. You just wouldn't play them. It's like less involving than one of the Lego games. I like those games, but they are very simple games. It's doesn't even have that. It sucks. It made me sad.
I think while making this game, the developers were distracted by David Perry putting a lot of things in boxes. So that's why this game didn't turn out the way it should have. But, I mean, how good could a Golden Compass game be in the first place? I'm not really sure. This is not... I mean, the movie made money, but this is not a well-remembered film. This is not a game people wanted to play.
If they decided to do a Matrix Path of Neo, but the Golden Compass, I suppose it could have been
Let me
something
play
more
as Nicole Kidman. Who are these kids? Mm. I didn't read the books. I'm sorry, folks.
There was one thing I did like about this game, which is that you're playing as the girl Lyra on the back of a polar bear. And when you press R1, the polar bear does a block and it sort of gets up on its hind legs and does like a really anime looking block move. And it's kind of funny.
One redeeming
I don't know
feature.
If that's from the movie or not.
But yeah, that is their last game. And we could talk about the fate of Shiny. So their history with publishers is very, very confusing. And I try to nail it all down here. So after Jim, they were acquired by Interplay. I believe they were a Playmates company before that. Interplay folded. Shiny was acquired by Atari. They were sold off to Foundation 9. Shiny and the Collected were merged into Double Helix Games. And then that was merged into Amazon Game Studios. And now Amazon Game Studios, despite not making a whole lot in their 15-ish years of existence, they are now working on the new Tomb Raider game. So potentially some Shiny people could be working on those. I'm not sure because they're not out yet. So that is just like how many times Shiny was sold and combined and resold over the last 30-plus years.
I would, as a word, Double Helix made some cool stuff, actually. They did that Killer Instinct reboot, and they did the 2014 version of Strider.
And
Among others.
So that's I forgot about that. That's pretty awesome. And
the Killer Instinct was dope. I love that.
Nick Brody, we mentioned he works for Digital Eclipse. He has been art director on things like the Wizardry Remake in 2023, the Mortal Kombat Legacy Collection. And also, he was art director on the 2019 Medieval Remake, the Medieval PlayStation spooky platformer series. I
mean, that's some good art directing going on right there. That's a fantastic looking game.
And in terms of what David Perry's been up to, I could tell you he's been up to being very rich because it seems like his thing is creating companies and then selling them for tens of millions of dollars. So he went from Shiny in 2006. He resigned from Shiny. He went for the gaming industry's sweetest plum, which is consultancy. That's where a lot of these guys end up doing mock reviews for games and making a lot of money because this is an important function of the gaming industry. We need to know like how these games will perform when we release them. And then he becomes the Gaikai guy. So Gaikai was a very important company in terms of creating like cloud computing technology. And that was acquired by Sony for a lot of money. And I believe Gaikai technology is what currently powers a lot of Sony's cloud gaming technology to this day. And right now, it seems like his latest venture is an AI video startup, and I wish him the worst for this because this is not a place he should end up. He should be doing things that involve like hiring people to make arts, not having computers do it for him. But that is essentially what David Perry's been up to since 2006. And I guess Gaikai, he was always like into tech more than anything, and that is very important tech.
Dang, so I was mistaken. Who was I thinking of at Meta then, if it wasn't Dave Perry?
That might have been one of his many stops along the way because he likes to do a lot of stuff. So he might not just be doing the AI
there,
thing.
I will say, though, going back to Nick Brody and some of the other ex-Shiny people, they all got involved. Some of them got involved with Intellivision Amico. Mm. Nick Brody actually developed the Amico version of Astro Smash, which was complete. I've actually played it. It does exist. He finished the game. never released, obviously. The Amico itself is a very strange machine. Not good, but I have played it. It also got... It resulted in some pretty serious issues between us and Tommy Tallarico and Hans Ippisch.
Tommy seems so nice.
We talked about it on a DF Direct Weekly, basically like the delay and issues around the Amico, just reporting stuff. And they basically started threatening us and all kinds of stuff and like really like insulting us, telling us we should fire some of the employees at DF. And like it just got really heated and nasty. It was not a good time.
Again, if you want to know more about Tommy Tallarico, there's a 3-hour video out there waiting for you. And it's very, very informative and fun.
Very fun.
Any final thoughts on Shiny? Like, I feel that the spirit of Shiny can now be seen in the freedom of the digital marketplace in places like Steam, where so many of games that could have been a Shiny box product for $50 25 years ago are now just a $10 or $20 product on Steam that is has like a lot of more thought put behind it, because it's not meant to be this be-all, end-all box product to change our lives forever. It's like, we thought of this fun little idea. We worked with 8 people for 5 years on it. Here it is. And, it just is a different landscape that I think is more friendly to these Shiny style ideas. So maybe they help pave the way for weirdness in video games. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, the spirit of Shiny, I do look back on a lot of these games we talked about today, and I still have very positive thoughts about them. I think they made some cool stuff and they attempted some cool stuff, and it's kind of sad that it wound down the way it did, but they had a good run.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like, with the exception of the Golden Compass, which is coughing up blood big time, I don't think there's a single game on this list that I wouldn't at least say, this is interesting, this is worth seeing, this is worth playing, this is worth hearing. They never made anything that had zero value, I guess, which isn't maybe the nicest thing to say, but I'm trying to be positive. I hope people understand what I'm trying to say about them. They were good and cool, and it's sad that they are not there.
Absolutely. Anymore. Well, thank you, John and Stuart. This has been another episode of Retronauts, and I have been your host, Bob Mackey. And if you want to support the show and get these episodes ad-free and also get access a ton of bonus episodes behind the paywall, I believe over 200 to date at this point, go to patreon.com/retronauts and sign up there for $5 a month. You get ad-free episodes a week ahead of time. And like I said, we have a bunch of exclusive ones. We do 2 a month for people on the Patreon. They are full length about topics you love. So if you want to sign up for $5, you can support the show and get a ton of bonus podcasts on top of that. That sounds like a good deal to me. And I will do my own personal plugs last. Let's go around the virtual room here. And now we can stop holding hands finally. And let's go to John for his plugs. John, where can we find you online?
Yes, I'm at social media under Dark1X, but I'm with Digital Foundry, of course. You can find us at digitalfoundry.net. We do have a Patreon over there. And if you like retro podcasts as well, I do have a retro podcast over there. Maybe someday get Bob and Stuart on there, do a little cross-pollination. It's DF Retro Super Show.
I love it.
It's a little different than Retronauts. We have a slightly different focus, but, you know, more retro podcasts, not a bad thing.
And Stuart, how about you?
I'm Stuart Jerp. You know me mostly from Retronauts, I'm sure. I did a book called All Games Are Good that you can get from Limited Run Games, and I recommend you buy it because I think it's excellent. I would do, but you know. And you can find me on social media, stuartjerp.bluesky.social, but I wouldn't really recommend it because I'm annoying on there. Sorry.
As for me, I'm sometimes annoying, and you can find me on places like Blue Sky and Letterboxd as Bob Servo. And of course, you probably know this, but I do other podcasts for the Talking Simpsons Network. You can find those wherever you find podcasts. Talking Simpsons, What a Cartoon, what have you. And we have a Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. Sign up there. You can get access to a ton of bonus episodes about shows like Futurama, King of the Hill, and others. But that is it for this episode of Retronauts. We'll see you again very soon for another episode. Take care.